Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. Over the past century, millions of lives have been saved thanks to antibiotics. Together with the prevention of illnesses that are now vaccine preventable, many of us are alive today thanks to progress in the prevention and treatment of infectious diseases. Yet, like any drug, antibiotics can have undesired effects, and the emergence of multiple drug-resistant strains of bacteria threatens the effectiveness of these seemingly miraculous drugs. For our program today, we'll address three aspects of antibiotics: the good, that is, the benefits; the bad, the undesirable effects; and the ugly, the emergence of drug-resistant strains, but also what can we do about it. So joining me in the studio today are two of the most knowledgeable people in Alaska on the topic. Thaddeus Wilkerson is an infectious disease clinical pharmacist who until recently served as director of statewide antimicrobial stewardship services for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Thaddeus was born and raised on the Navajo Nation and grew up in Shiprock, New Mexico, received his doctorate in pharmacy in 2007 from the University of New Mexico, and has 11 years of clinical experience combined with adult critical care and infectious diseases, and he was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Public Health Service. Thaddeus, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Jay.
And Dr. Ben Wesley is an infectious disease physician in Anchorage. Dr. Wesley was born and raised in Anchorage, attended Diamond High School, and is a graduate of the Whammy Medical School. He went to residency, did a combined residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of California, San Diego, and his infectious diseases subspecialty training was obtained at Brown University. That's an outstanding training. Dr. Wesley, welcome to Line One.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we invite all of you to join the conversation. Questions about antibiotics, or if you've had an experience with a drug-resistant infection and would like to share the experience with others, please join us by calling statewide. The number is toll-free, 888-353-5752. That's 888-353-5752. And you can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So we always like to start with some definitions, some of the seemingly simple things. So let's just start with, what is an antibiotic?
I think I can take that one this morning, Jay. Being a pharmacist, antibiotics are probably one of the most important medications that are available to us within the pharmacy. And an antibiotic is a medication. It's a natural substance, actually, that has the ability to inhibit the growth of bacteria. And I wanted to distinguish, oftentimes when we hear the word antimicrobial, it can get confused with antibiotic. So when we use the word antimicrobial, we're including antibiotics, antivirals, and antifungals. So specifically, we'll probably be concentrating on antibiotics today, but in essence, it's a medication that we can take orally, intravenously, or even topically, different routes of administration to inhibit growth of bacteria, with the goal of targeting harmful bacteria, but unfortunately, sometimes we kill the good bacteria as well.
We had a discussion of the microbiome and the relationship between our gut bacteria to colon cancer a couple of months ago, and certainly we touched on that aspect of that being one of the bad aspects of antibiotics. You mentioned that these are natural substances. I believe that is part of the story of the discovery of penicillin, isn't it, Dr. Wesley?
It is. That's an awfully exciting thing, and I think many people know the story of probably the most famous antibiotic, penicillin. Sir Alexander Fleming was not Sir at the time that he discovered this, but he was a British microbiologist and routinely every morning, early in the morning, would look at his plates of cultures. And same as today, staphylococcal infections and streptococcal infections of the skin primarily were a big plague. And on one day, he found a spot of a reddish fungus growing on the petri dish, and there was a big black area around it where there were no bacteria growing anywhere near that spot of fungus, and that ended up being a Penicillium fungus. And he pretty rapidly came to the conclusion that that fungus must be secreting some type of substance that's killing the bacteria, not allowing them to grow anywhere near the fungal organism. And so he did some other stuff with it, but he was not a chemist. He was not a microbiologist. He was a microbiologist, not a chemist. So he could not actually purify that material. So he wrote this in journals mid-1930s, and it sort of sat there in the literature for a while until it was found by a group at Oxford, Florey and a group who read that, looking through old journals to try to find substances they could make into antimicrobials. And they contacted him, and they obtained that, and they were actually able to purify that substance made from the fungus, and really resulted in a phenomenal discovery for humankind, frankly.
So a sharp scientist, maybe a little sloppy in the laboratory, but I think it was Pasteur who said, chance favors the prepared mind, and certainly Fleming and then Dr. Florey and colleagues were prepared for that serendipitous discovery.
Well, and what's fascinating about it, too, is when people have gone back and looked, really, was he the first person to discover this? It turns out the ancient Egyptians apparently deciphered through sociologists have determined that a poultice of moldy bread was a very, very common remedy for infected wounds and skin infections in ancient Egyptian times. And it seems quite likely that there were, in fact, antimicrobials being secreted from the moldy poultice used unknowingly by them, perhaps penicillin.
Wow. And of course, penicillium itself is a fungus, and as we've learned as in the 20th and 21st century, both with immunosuppressive medications and the emergence of human immunodeficiency virus, penicillium itself sometimes can cause disease as well. So it's a fascinating story of the whole microbial milieu in which we live and which lives within us as well.
And if I remember correctly, Fleming did warn against antibiotic resistance during his acceptance speech, even though it hadn't been widely adopted and implemented within routine medical care. He did say, this agent, this technology needs to be used judiciously.
Yes, and Fleming received the Nobel Prize sometime in the mid-40s and related to that. So how have antibiotics improved life?
I think antibiotics have improved life dramatically when we think about advances in organ transplant with cancer chemotherapy. Often in those situations, patients are on immunosuppressants that can drop their normal response to combat infections, and normal bacteria can actually be life-threatening and deadly to folks who don't have an intact immune system. So it has led that part of medicine to extend beyond. I think even to the simple infections of pneumonia is very important. Skin and soft tissue infections that previously, if we think about during world wars, where it was amputation was the goal, or patients were getting septicemia, now we finally have an agent there to send our troops home.
Yeah. And I can really paint, I think, a pretty specific picture of a couple things that our listeners could envision. 100 to 150 years ago in Germany, in the wards where physicians were taking care of pregnant women, a very large number of them became septic after delivering their babies. And Dr. Semmelweis discovered that because the physicians weren't washing their hands, many women became infected with streptococcal bacteria. There were no treatments. All they could do was provide some supportive care and try to hydrate the women, and some would survive and some wouldn't. Now, currently in our programs in the hospitals, pneumonia, skin infections, and urine infections are three of the biggest things that we take care of people in the hospital for. And literally until the late 1930s, early 1940s, there were no specific treatments for those things other than giving fluids and comfort to those patients, and some would survive and some wouldn't. So all of these things that we routinely treat with antibiotics and really don't think much about nowadays, hospitals were full of people for which we really did not have a specific form of treatment. It's quite dramatic.
So we have a caller. Don, welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Yeah, first I guess I should apologize. I might be getting ahead of the conversation here with this question, but I know that there are problems with antibiotic resistance, and it's my understanding that some of that is related to overuse in the medical profession, but also in subtherapeutic doses in livestock facilities, you know, in any combination where, I mean, Alexander Fleming himself back in the 40s or 50s warned about, creeping antibiotic resistance even in those days. And what I was wondering was what you would think about instituting a tax on antibiotics as a way of discouraging overuse.
Wow. And great question. Thaddeus or Ben?
Well, I'm a little bit familiar with antibiotic use in agriculture and the food industry. There have been a number of early reports and observations when animals were given antibiotics that they tended to get a little fatter quicker and actually were promoted by the industry as growth promoters. And so in low doses given within the animal feed or put into the watering systems, they did and up till recently use antibiotics specifically for that purpose. I think where the concern when we look at antibiotic use that we use in humans kind of has a larger concern when we start using them within animals. Fortunately, this has been addressed by a number of organizations, and specifically regulations were put in place in January of 2017 to remove that labeling for antibiotics to be used as growth promoters, for there to be an established infection for antibiotics to be used and to be governed by a veterinarian in that practice. So I'm glad to see that that is moving forward. And many of the, if you even think of fast food restaurants, are now promoting that they serve chicken or beef that is antibiotic free. To get to the question of a tax, I think I'll punt that one to Ben.
The only thing I know about taxes is that I pay too many of them. So I'm really not an expert on this. What I can say is that without antibiotics, the growth is slower. So you're going to pay more for a chicken that isn't given antibiotics per pound than you are the chicken. So there's some merit to the idea of a tax because, if the price is going up, is that going to go to consumers or not? But then there's also the double negative of if you tax it, then the chicken's going to become more expensive to consumer regardless of whether you tax it one way or the other. But we are using altogether too many antibiotics for making livestock larger and even probably not simply livestock. Humans are organisms, and there is a massive amount of epidemiological data that children that are exposed to antibiotics in early childhood have a much higher risk of overweight and obesity, about a relative risk of about 1.25. And it's been shown in hundreds of thousands of children in meta-analyses. And there is some argument as to whether, well, are the infections causing the children to be overweight? Because it's hard to detach antibiotic use from infection rates because you use antibiotics for infections, theoretically. But what we know about children that get infections over and over is they tend to not grow well, not grow too much. So humans are not immune to the rapid growth problem when they receive antibiotics.
Yeah, it's certainly another area where there's active research on the microbiome. There's interest in the animal husbandry industry, that if animals are fed the appropriate probiotics, actually the gain that they have seen in the past with subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics could actually be realized. So I'm not an expert in that area, but I find that to be a fascinating area of research. And who knows what we'll be talking about 10 years from now about antibiotics in the microbiome. So, Don, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. This is Dr. Jay Butler, your host today. We're talking about antibiotics with infectious disease specialist Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson and Ben Wesley. We invite you to join the conversation. Toll-free statewide, 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. That email address, again, is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about some of the downsides of antibiotics. Let's just start very generally. What are some of the undesirable effects of taking an antibiotic?
Yeah, 1 in 1,000 antibiotic prescriptions leads to a visit for an adverse drug event. 142,000 ER visits annually as a result of side effects that can occur. And often these presentations are in children, and they present with rash. And I think most people have had some form of reaction to an antibiotic, and or at least have heard or know of somebody who's had a rash to receiving an antibiotic. That rash can be something that's very mild and short in duration, or it can be quite severe. During my training in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I actually had an unfortunate opportunity to assist in the treatment of a patient who had Stevens-Johnson syndrome as a result of exposure to a particular sulfa medication. And that rash had developed into full desquamation and slothing of that individual's skin and was being treated in a burn unit. Other side effects well noted for fluoroquinolones, which is a particular broad spectrum class of antibiotics. The FDA has just put out some reports. It increased the severity of labeling for some side effects that are most notably to central nervous system altercations, paresthesias, nerve pains, rare reactions like Achilles tendon rupture in the elderly, and also dysglycemia, so a patient who is diabetic who's trying to maintain tight control of their blood sugar. This medication can actually either increase or decrease their blood glucose levels and make it a little bit more difficult for them to handle that. The side effect profile is different for each antibiotic class, but I think they all, for the most part, have the potential to cause alterations within, we've already been talking about, the gut microbiota. And I think probably the one that hits home is Clostridium difficile. Antibiotic-associated diarrhea is very common, but it can lead to severe megacolon and death if it gets to the point to where we have a severe Clostridium difficile or C. diff infection.
So you're describing an infectious disease that's actually caused by antibiotics potentially.
Exactly. And really what's fascinating about that story was originally that diarrheal illness was called clindamycin-associated diarrhea in the late 1970s because that was the one antibiotic that seemed to cause the occurrence of that. And the reason for that was because at the time, the Clostridium difficile species were susceptible to penicillin. They were susceptible to the early fluoroquinolones. They were susceptible to the antibiotics that were most widely used at the time. And clindamycin was relatively new and by chance did not kill Clostridium difficile. But over time, it became resistant to most of the other antibiotics we routinely use. And now it's a real struggle to treat.
Okay. So antibiotics can give us some miracles, but there are downsides as well. So I think it's time to go to a break, give the stations down the line a minute. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. We're talking about antibiotics, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. With me here in the studio are Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson and Dr. Benjamin Wesley. Our discussion today is on antibiotics. Drs. Wilkerson and Wesley are both infectious disease specialists. We were talking a bit just before the break about the downsides of antibiotics. And Dr. Wilkerson, as a pharmacist, I look to you with a lot of respect because you understand some of the drug interactions as well as the toxicity oftentimes better than I may as I'm trying to quickly see a number of patients. Tell us a little more about that. And who should worry?
Absolutely.
Other than the prescribing physician.
I think it comes down to the particular antibiotic. Pharmacists are trained to do therapeutic drug monitoring for a medication called vancomycin. So when patients are admitted to the hospital, this medication is used to treat MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And this agent has a narrow therapeutic window. So too much can be toxic to the kidneys, not enough can result in treatment failure, and it requires very close monitoring, weight-based dosing, multiple blood levels to be obtained to make sure that we're getting the right dose, and hopefully we're using the right drug for that particular infection. So kidney toxicity is something very important that actually crosses a number of antibiotic classes because many of these medications are cleared and eliminated, excreted through the urine and processed by the kidney. And I'm glad you brought up the point of drug-drug interactions. That's something very important even in ambulatory care in the outpatient setting. When I'm training residents and students and looking for drug interactions, sometimes it's not a drug interaction like we think of that it has the ability to increase or decrease levels in the body, but rather having added toxicities. I think a perfect example of that is the antibiotic Bactrim when given in combination with some antihypertensive medications like lisinopril, or if somebody is taking a potassium supplement and they're taking Bactrim on top of that, that can increase the potassium levels in their body, and it does require additional monitoring during the course of treatment and after the completion of course of treatment. Probably one of the most significant drug-drug interactions when I think about the use of anticoagulants and specifically warfarin, antibiotics, and a pharmacist should always be screening through to see if that's going to affect the level of anticoagulant activity of warfarin if given in combination with an antibiotic. It either can be associated with the drugs themselves interacting or the effects that it has on the gut bugs that are vitamin K producing.
Right. So you just reminded me of one of the historical stories that I think we're aware of that listeners may not be aware of. And one of the early uses of penicillin was after the Coconut Grove fire in Boston in the early 40s, and penicillin was a brand new drug. Most of the bacteria are so exquisitely susceptible that patients who were administered penicillin, they collected the urine and actually recovered penicillin that was then used again to treat more patients. We don't do that nowadays, but it's a remarkable story of the value of recycling as well as how precious penicillin was at the time when it was in very early production.
Yeah, that's really a phenomenal story that it required thousands of liters of fungal extract to create simply enough penicillin really for a couple treatment courses, and one of the microbiology techs in Flory's lab there in Oxford brought a cantaloupe back from the store, from the market, one day when they were working on trying to make more penicillin out of the fungal. And it was a penicillium species, a different species of penicillium than that they had been working with. And it created 1,000 times more penicillin per unit of fungus than the prototypical Fleming penicillium. And so they hit upon this simply from a cantaloupe brought back from one of their lab techs that they were able to dramatically increase their penicillin yield.
Wow. So just to be clear, for laboratory safety, we don't recommend bringing your food into the lab, but it again shows the fact that antibiotics coming from natural organisms that really exist all around us. So that maybe is a good segue into talking about antibiotic resistance, because in nature we have these organisms that are excreting these substances that inhibit their competitors. And of course there would be an advantage for a bacteria to be able to develop a resistance. How does that happen? How does that work? And particularly in the context of someone being treated with an antibiotic.
Sure. Just like the antibiotic itself has been a compound that's been around, resistance mechanisms have been around as well. And resistant mechanisms can vary depending upon the type of bacteria. Often we group bacteria, gram-positive, gram-negative bacteria that have differences in how their outer structure is made up. So there may be an inherent resistance mechanism for a particular bacteria in a combination with a particular antibiotic for it not to work. It may not be able to penetrate into the bacteria where maybe that antibiotic's target site for efficacy is. The bacteria may have an efflux mechanism, or the ability to pump antibiotic outside of the inside of the cell if it managed to get in and that was where its activity was. There's also selection pressure. So if somebody is taking an antibiotic to treat an infection and it is highly effective, it can kill off the majority of the bacteria there. With a few that have that inherent resistance gene potentially, and then selects for those to grow. And those resistance genes can be transferred between bacteria as well. So it can get very complex in a resistance mechanism. There can be multiple resistance mechanisms that work concurrently, or oftentimes it can be just a simple point mutation of where that antibiotic is supposed to work.
Yeah, the way I describe it to patients and the way I think about it is, if you envision that you have a million different bacteria laying on a table, or even just 10 different bacteria laying on a table, and one of those 10 is resistant to the antibiotic that you give somebody, you're going to kill the 9, but that 1 is going to be left over, and bacteria divide every 20 minutes. So it does not take long for that 1 that happened to be born by chance as a bacteria that's resistant to the antibiotic to perpetrate and grow. It's not much different than Darwin's finches, where one of them was born with a longer beak by happenstance, and then it tended to eat better and grow better. So these resistance mechanisms, they can occur de novo in nature, and we've seen that many times. But they can also simply be that bacteria are so diverse. Probably every form of resistance to any antibiotic we'll ever create is already existing somewhere on Earth. Caves that have never been touched by humankind, deep, deep in caves that were finally accessed for the first time by humans 5 or 10 years ago, clearly never have seen an antibiotic in their life. Bacteria were isolated from those caves that are resistant to carbapenems, resistant to vancomycin, resistant to virtually any form of antibiotic that we could ever create. It's the selection process where the antibiotics, if used repeatedly and over time, all the stuff that's killed by those antibiotics dies, and only the resistant bacteria survive, and then they become more and more prevalent.
Okay. So I want to remind listeners who may not be aware, the Alaska Public Media Line 1 website has additional materials. And Dr. Wesley, your reference to bacteria on the table reminds me of a link that we placed on that website that was produced by the Harvard Medical School. And it's a fascinating time-lapse video showing how antibiotics can be selected and reproduced. It's actually a time-lapse of literally a table-sized sheet of agar that's about 4 feet by a couple of feet, and it has sequentially increasing concentrations of antibiotics. So you can see how the bacteria grow. You know, a single mutation will occur, and then that will continue to grow. And then they've done the genetic analysis as well, so they can superimpose on that remarkable visual that you've just seen grow out over a period of several days in a two-minute video to show the relatedness between those bacteria. We have a couple of questions coming in by email also. So we talked about the microbiome. We touched on probiotics for animals. So here's actually a question that we hear a number of people ask. They've recently been on antibiotics for a prolonged period of time, and they'd like to know how do they figure out how much probiotic to take in order to get their gut in right order again.
If they figure it out, they should let me know.
Let me know as well,
so that we can retire rich. Nobody knows, and many studies on probiotics have been done. Virtually all of them on widely varying combinations of different organisms and on different doses. And in fact, because these medications are by and large not produced by pharmaceutical industries at extremely tightly regulated or controlled dosing, it is very hard to even know what one is taking, even if one thinks one knows what one is taking. So I do not know the answer to that question, and I'm not sure if anybody really does.
So it sounds like you're saying the marketing may have gotten out a bit ahead of the science on this.
I think when you look at the science behind it, and when it shows that there is benefit for probiotics to decrease antibiotic-associated diarrhea, I think that's pretty convincing. There's evolving literature to say, can it prevent the onset of Clostridium difficile, or can it actually treat Clostridium difficile? I don't think the evidence is strong enough there. And really what we're looking at is a pooling of smaller studies. So like Dr. Wesley had mentioned, it could have been lactobacillus, it could have been bifidobacterium or Saccharomyces boulardii, and then the dosing was never standardized. And so in essence, even within Anchorage with our antimicrobial stewardship programs and promoting the use of a probiotic while patients are on antibiotics in the hospital, we have different dosing strategies just because no one really knows.
Yeah. So, and we have a related question specifically related to small intestine bacterial overgrowth. And I think the question that's raised here, I think, is important. Are all antibiotics created equal? And I think, you know, all of us have heard the term big gun antibiotics. Maybe we need laser focused antibiotics when we're talking about the effects on the bowel.
Yeah, all antibiotics are not created equal, and some are more equal than others, which is an Orwellian concept.
It's a little scary, Dr. Wesley.
Yes. Different antibiotics kill different forms of bacteria. And bacteria in our bodies and in our normal microbiome living on us live in different areas. So the small bowel has different types of bacteria living in it than the colon or than the mouth or than the armpits or the nose. And so depending on what antibiotic one gets, which is hopefully targeted for the type of infection they actually have, that will somewhat predict what areas of the body are going to be hit more with side effects from a particular antibiotic.
Okay. I'll take a chance to remind you, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. We're discussing antibiotics, the good, the bad, and the ugly, with infectious disease specialists Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson and Dr. Ben Wesley. We welcome you to join the conversation by calling us at 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So the headlines have been filled past few years about different types of superbugs. What should we really be worrying about? What are the types of infections that wake you up at 3 in the morning in a cold sweat? Not personally, but worrying about them.
I've been worried about CREs, and I think that's when people hear the term superbug, that's in essence what we're referring to, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. In other words, this is an E. coli or a Klebsiella. It's a gram-negative type bug that has the ability to resist the effects of one of the most powerful antibiotics that we have in our armamentarium called the carbapenems. And this particular class of medications is something, as a stewardship pharmacist, that I try to reserve and keep on the shelf for when we actually need to use it. I would call a carbapenem a big gun, a broad-spectrum active agent. The CRE, or KPC, is also referenced within the media, is in essence resistant to most, if not all, antibiotics that we have available. And there have been some reported deaths associated with that. In fact, the CDC, when they reported out their first, statistical analysis and assessment of antibiotic use and resistance, and looking back in 2011 to 2015, they were looking at about 23,000 deaths occur annually as a result of resistant infections, with 2 million affected annually in the United States by resistance.
And it's, what is most compelling to me about that is looking at the epidemiological map of antibiotic use around the world. So the most famous of these, perhaps, was the NDM1, New Delhi metallobeta-lactamase 1 in 2008, a Swedish patient of Indian origin who was in the Asian subcontinent and apparently acquired this bacteria that was resistant to meropenem or these other carbapenem antibiotics. If you look at the amount of carbapenem use in the Mediterranean area on a global map of antibiotic use, some countries such as Greece, 40, 50, 60% of patients needing gram-negative bacteria treatment were getting treated with carbapenems. Now, this is probably because 10 to 15 years earlier, so many of them had received third-generation cephalosporin antibiotics.
All right.
Over-the-counter or in unregulated pharmacies for colds or bronchitis or whatever, then the very large amount of what we call ESBL, extended spectrum beta-lactamases, that destroy all cephalosporins. So they, by necessity, moving over to carbapenems, and such a large amount of the population receiving carbapenems, simply by natural laws of Earth, select for carbapenem-resistant bacteria, and we end up with the problem we have.
Yeah. So I'd like to take a call. Brenda, welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask about all the antibacterial lotion and soaps and all that stuff that's on the market now and how it's affecting all the infections. And I'll listen to your answer over the radio. Thank you for taking my call. Bye.
Well, thank you for joining us, Brenda. So I think Brenda actually raises two questions there. One is all the antibacterial products. I think you can even buy mattresses that are impregnated with things like triclosan. But also there's alcohol-based cleaners, which, of course, are important in some of the rural parts of the state where access to running water and soap may be more limited than they should be.
Right. I was just having a conversation with my neighbor about this last night because he was asking, should I be using antibacterial soaps? And I said, let me first educate you on proper hand hygiene with regular soap and water.
Just soap, not antibacterial soap.
And there definitely was an opportunity to educate on getting between the fingers and underneath the nails and doing it for at least 20 seconds. In the community, I think there is a fear of bacteria in general, and we have a commensal relationship with bacteria. We evolved and developed as humans to have things living in us and on us, whether it be bacteria, viruses, or fungus, as part of our microbiome. So using antibacterial soaps can affect that normal flora, the good bacteria that are on our hands. So I generally discourage within the community folks using antibacterial type agents. Now, it's a little different when you get into a healthcare setting within the hospital and hand hygiene. And we do use alcohol-based sanitizers, gels, and foams before having contact with patients entering the room and leaving the room to help facilitate the hand hygiene. The bugs are a little different within the hospital than they are within the community. And there's even been a push within the hospitals to be removing agents like triclosan from the sanitizers that we are using and have available.
All right. We need to go to a break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're talking about antibiotics today. We'll be right back.
Funding for Line One, Your Health Connection was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. With me in the studio are Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson and Dr. Ben Wesley. Both are infectious disease specialists, and we are talking about antibiotics. So we'd love to have you join the conversation. You can reach us statewide, toll-free, 888-353-5752. And if you want to stay on the line after we talk, we'd love, if you're not yet a member of Alaska Public Media, we'd love to have a further conversation with you. Also, you can email us questions at line1@alaskapublic.org. So we've talked about some of the challenges created by antibiotics, of course, starting with the things we take for granted, just how many things that used to contribute to the fact that life expectancy in the early 20th century was just in the mid-40s. Most of us now should be able to expect getting into our late 70s, early 80s, and a lot of that being because of antibiotics. We have emerging resistance, though, that is concerning. So I'm going to channel Ann Hillman and open here the Medical Bureau of the Solutions Desk. What can we do about this? Dr. Wilkerson, you mentioned you described yourself as a stewardship pharmacist. Let's talk about antimicrobial stewardship.
Sure. The way I define antimicrobial stewardship is using antibiotics wisely in the most simple terms. Another way I've explained it is the D's of stewardship. So getting the right diagnosis, using the right drug at the right dose for the appropriate duration, and if opportunity affords it, to de-escalate the antibiotic to something that might be more narrow spectrum, or to discontinue it if you find that the diagnosis was wrong up front. So in the most simple terms, that's what I've been doing for the past 5 to 6 years, is helping physicians and providers who have prescriptive authority, as well as nurses or anybody who's involved in the administering and monitoring of antibiotics, to educate them about how to use antibiotics wisely.
Okay. So how do you do that? What are the tools in the antimicrobial stewardship toolbox?
Well, what we have found is that even for infectious disease specialists, it's very hard to get exactly correct the right treatment for every single individual patient. And it's really not feasible and not really fair to expect every physician or every provider to know off the top of their head the exact optimal treatment for their patient when they come in, because they have to deal with so many different things on a daily basis. So one of the biggest things we do is education, but not simply just talking or going around and saying, hey, do this or this, but trying to say, okay, what things are the most common? We mentioned them earlier. Pneumonia, skin infections, urine infections, or even other less severe respiratory infections like sinusitis, bronchitis, or ear infections in children, et cetera. And then to provide them guidance and basically a process or a guideline to say, when you see this problem, here's what you should think about, and here are the best antibiotics specifically for us at our hospital or in Alaska or in your population. Because it turns out, even within Alaska, there are different optimal treatments for the same problem, depending on what kind of resistance is present. Just like I mentioned in Eastern European areas, the optimal treatment for urine infection there will not be the same as it is here, because they have different type of bacteria floating around and infecting their patients. And it's not reasonable to expect doctors, many of whom travel around the country and work in different places week to week, to know this off the top of their head. So we provide them with a whole bunch of different algorithms they can use to quickly look and reference and pick the best treatment for their patients.
Okay. So it's really the technical support, but also, if you will, the human behavior aspect of how do we provide the best information, but also influence behavior as it relates to prescribing and use of antibiotics.
Human behavior is probably the largest component of stewardship. It definitely requires holding folks accountable, empowerment through partnership. And I think in the state of Alaska, we actually have pretty much mastered the ability with our healthcare system to work with others and pool our resources together. So we established an Alaska Antimicrobial Stewardship Collaborative a couple of years ago, and that includes members from the hospital sector, the outpatient nursing home, as well as the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association, our quality improvement organization, as well as the State Department of Health, have all pooled together resources, be it financial support, education through training, or collaborations for the development of particular treatment guidelines and pathways. And most notably, we have been monitoring resistance across the state and creating and modifying our guidelines based upon the regional variances that we have seen.
Okay. So let's take a call. Bobby, welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Hi, I have a question here. When a person takes antibiotics for a certain disease and it kills that disease, does it also kill all the natural little bugs and germs that we naturally have in our stomach? And if so, how long does it take for all those good little bugs in our stomach to return?
Yeah, so recovery, we were talking earlier about the impact of antibiotics on the microbiome. We had questions about probiotics, which we said there really isn't a good answer to at this point. But if we're just looking at getting back to normal, how long does that take?
That's a very perceptive question, and the answer is absolutely yes. We, as humans, have 10 bacteria cells in our intestines for every one human cell in our body.
My gosh, so we're outnumbered.
As a species, we are 90% poop. And when you receive antibiotics, many of the good bacteria in our intestines are killed. So this includes E. coli and Klebsiella, things like that. But also, for all those bacteria in our intestines, there are 10 anaerobic bacteria for every one bacteria that needs oxygen. And those anaerobic bacteria that live without oxygen are really, really important to keeping the intestines healthy. So when those are killed, quite a lot of symptoms can occur from a GI standpoint. And Dr. Wilkerson, I think, probably knows better the statistics on how long it takes for the microbiome to recover after antibiotic course.
it actually does depend upon the agent that is used. We talked about broad spectrum versus narrow spectrum.
The big guns versus the lasers.
Right. There are particular antibiotics that actually take a good hit at these anaerobes that Dr. Wesley was mentioning. And so if we knock out lactobacillus and some of these other anaerobes that are there normally good for us, the recovery can take anywhere from 3 months. It can actually take years, depending upon how hard it's hit and repeated courses. But even as single as one or two doses of clindamycin, for instance, will take 3 to 4 months for a full recovery of the microbiome, the GI microbiome. So it definitely is dependent upon the antibiotic that is given, the duration of exposure, and really the individual patient factors of nutrition and diet also play a factor in there as well.
All right. Bobby, thank you for joining us on line one. Let's actually go to a very provocative question from William. I think he wants to ask about the potential for a moratorium on antibiotics. William, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, theoretically, could a moratorium be set up against the use of antibiotics in order to restore the natural biome? In other words, it would seem to me that the original strains that were non-resistant to antibiotics, which were susceptible to the antibiotics, would return and be more prolific than the strains that develop due to resistance to antibiotics. See what I'm saying? It's a species selective thing, that the resistant microbes, yes, are more, they're resistant to antibiotics. They have an advantage when antibiotics are present. But when antibiotics are not present, the strains that are resistant to antibiotics have a reproductive advantage. Okay, it would be like setting the clock back to zero, to the day or the time that Sir Alexander Fleming was confronted at that time with the same biome that, that he addressed, which were not resistant to antibiotics.
So that it's a great question, and it's been thought of in many times before. Technically and theoretically, it absolutely would work, and we do occasionally see staphylococci that are still susceptible to penicillin. 1 or 2% are. Those strains would come back if you could eliminate all use of any antibiotic in that same class that would kill those. It's not feasible worldwide to do so, but in a microcosm, this has been tried. So intensive care units are tiny little really critical areas of the hospital that are sort of locked down in a way. They're kind of slightly isolated from the rest of the hospital. And so antibiotic resistance there has been tried to be attacked by disallowing virtually all but a couple limited antibiotics. And then it would rotate. So for every 3 months, they would change what their usual treatment for severe infections or sepsis was. And as you can probably imagine, in fact, if you stop using a medication we call piperacillin tazobactam, it doesn't take long in the unit for the susceptibilities to improve to that agent. But at the same time, they're dropping virtually exactly the same rate to whatever other agent you used. This would be the proverbial squeezing the balloon. And so to large effect, there isn't a long-term and broad advantage to doing so that's ever been shown. What we do is we try to specifically disallow the absolutely critical antibiotics like the carbapenems, except for very specific criteria for use. And by doing so, try to prevent the emergence of resistance of those bacteria here in Alaska, for example. We use very small amounts of those antibiotics only in very limited specific situations to try to prevent that from happening. But technically, what he's proposing would work. We would not be able to treat very common infections, though.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us on line one, William. And this gets back a little bit to what Dr. Wilkerson was saying earlier about changes in animal husbandry practices, almost a moratorium on the way antibiotics have been used in the past as growth promoters.
Correct.
So we also have a question from Juno about whether or not rapid diagnostics improve empiric treatment and prevent antibiotic resistance. The words make me think this is someone inquiring from the healthcare industry.
Likely. We have been giving presentations on rapid diagnostics, and I think diagnostics is a component of stewardship. It's that first D in getting the diagnosis, and looking at some very targeted screening tools that we have, looking at for polymerase chain reaction, PCR, high technology things, to where before we were dependent upon getting a culture or getting a sample and doing a gram stain of that, then setting it up for culture. So we're starting broad spectrum empiric antibiotics for the first 2 to 3 days while we're waiting for things to grow on a plate. Well, now we have technology where we have identification potentially within hours to be able to get the antibiotic right. So there definitely is a role for rapid diagnostics, and more technology is evolving. And even on the back end, there are biomarkers that we use within diagnostics, procalcitonin, for instance, that may help us decide when to stop antibiotics and when it's safe to do that.
Dr. Wesley?
His answer is perfect and cannot be improved upon in any way, shape, or form.
However, I will say that in doing stewardship, these tests are often expensive, must be justified, and can often be used in inappropriate settings. It may not provide the benefit for the finances associated with it.
But as we've talked about the impact of big gun antibiotics as opposed to a laser focused antibiotic that gets just the bacteria that are causing the problem, it sounds like you're saying that the rapid diagnostics could potentially reduce the amount of exposure to the big gun antibiotics.
Absolutely. I think the biggest benefit there is helping us define, is this a bacterial infection or is this a viral infection? And if it's a viral infection, let's stop the antibiotic. On the complete opposite end of that is, I would want to know if somebody had a Staphylococcal aureus bacteremia, particular nasty bug, in the blood as soon as possible so that we can actually improve outcomes, decrease mortality by getting that right early up front.
Okay. So in our final minute here, we have actually a couple of inquiries asking, are we going to talk about phage therapy? I think the answer to that question is going to be yes, but very briefly. Do you want to comment? What is a phage?
Sure. It's a virus that attacks bacteria and can actually be one of the transporters of some resistance genes, and there are about 30 new non-antibiotic agents that are in studies right now. And phage therapy is one to say, can we actually kill the bacteria and control infection without the use of an antibiotic and using a virus vector instead?
Okay. Great. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us today. It's been a fascinating discussion. We will be wrapping up. This has been Dr. Jay Butler with Dr. Thaddeus Wilkerson and Dr. Ben Wesley. We've been talking about antibiotics, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll be back next week. Prentice Pemberton will be back in the saddle. His topic will be social wellness, and he'll be having a discussion with philosophy professor and author of Less Than Human, Dr. Livingston Smith. I'll look forward to talking to you again very soon. Dave Waldron was our producer as well as our sound engineer today. Eric Bork edited our web content. Thanks to Amitin, the intern of extraordinaire. And thank you for joining us today on Line One, Your Health Connection.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.